is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Do a percentage of how many good possessions there were. And I think that sort of helped us to understand, you know, controlling what we can control. And it also gives them a sense of, you know, I value more than just scoring. You know, I think, you know, we as coaches preach, do all the other things, you know, but stars are made by scoring 30 points. So I think sometimes your players need to see that that's how you really view basketball too, in order to really buy in.
Isaiah Cavaco just completed his 13th season as the head men's basketball coach at Oberlin College in Ohio. This year, his team set the school record for North Coast Athletic Conference wins with 9. Under Coach Cavaco's leadership, Oberlin completed their fourth 10-plus win season in 5 years, the first time that has ever been done at Oberlin. Isaiah grew up in Hawaii through 8th grade and then moved to California. He attended Mater Dei High School, where he was one of what ended up being 8 Division I players in his graduating class. Isaiah eventually transferred to Villa Park High School and was named second-team All-State by the Los Angeles Times in his senior year. Cavaco played his college ball at Yale University and started 46 games in his career, despite missing his entire junior season with 3 knee surgeries. Isaiah began his coaching career as a graduate assistant at Ohio University and then returned to his alma mater and was an assistant at Yale before leaving coaching briefly to go into the financial world. After getting the coaching bug again, he came back to coaching at John Carroll for the women's program, and then later became an assistant at Oberlin before taking over the program as the head coach. Don't forget to leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. That helps us continue to grow the show and reach more of the basketball community. Get ready to learn, and please make sure you have your pen and paper ready as you listen to this episode with Coach Isaiah Cavaco from Oberlin College in the state of Ohio.
Hello and welcome to the Hoop Heads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome from Oberlin College, Coach Isaiah Cavaco. Isaiah, welcome to the Hoop Heads Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We are glad that you were able to find some time in your schedule to come on and join us. And we're going to start by going back and talking about your playing career and how you got involved in the game of basketball for the first time as a kid. What was it about the game of basketball that made you fall in love with it when you were younger?
Well, I think I liked it the most because I saw my dad play it a lot. I kind of grew up in a family of coaches, and that was the sport that they loved the most. And so I guess I just sort of wanted to be a part of that. And then as a kid, you know, we'd spend a lot of time at the parks and, you know, doing all that fun stuff before the AAU rush and all that kind of thing. You know, it's just you go out there with your dad and your friends, and you know, that's kind of what I fell in love with.
Obviously, things were different for you and I when we were growing up and playing, coming up in the game where you're playing on the playground or playing with your kids in the neighborhood. And nowadays, kids are playing in the AAU system and going through and playing games in a gym with an official and coaches and mom and dad in the stands. So things are a lot different now. If you had to look at your own, you know, your own situation, how would you have felt about coming up in the system as it is today as compared to the way that you grew up with the game?
I think it was more, you know, you just kind of had to find your own path. And I think that's, you know, to me, how I remember it being really fun. You know, there was no right or wrong way. There wasn't, you know, sort of a laid out plan for you. Hey, go to this camp, attend these events, you know, work out with this trainer. You know, it was just, you sort of had a blind faith in yourself. And I thought that was kind of the fun part. You know, if I put in the time and I do the work, you know, I have no idea what anyone else is doing. All I know is that I'm confident in my own abilities. And I think maybe that piece has kind of gone away. And I think that was a big part for me. So, you know, coming up in the culture and the environment we have today, you know, I'll be honest, I'm a pretty confident guy, but I think I would have been a little bit more insecure seeing, you know, YouTube videos of what kids my age are doing that, you know, man, should I be at that level?
Yeah, exactly.
I think you lose, you know, your, I think why you play, and that's to sort of build your own, I guess, idea of yourself and gain the confidence based on your own work.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's interesting is that, at least for me, when I was a kid, one of the things that attracted me to the game of basketball was the fact that I didn't need anybody else to be able to go out and practice and work on my game. And so that was very, very attractive to me because I tended to be more dedicated than most of the people around me. So therefore, I could be out in my driveway or in my basement or in the living room and mom would let me dribble while I was watching TV and I could get better. And, you know, nowadays there's very, very few kids who are, you know, taking that time to get in the gym by themselves or just out on their driveway if they're a younger kid. Most kids need, you know, a trainer or a coach or a parent or somebody there to drive them or get them to the gym or take them to a workout. And that takes away at least a little bit of what I really loved about the game. I can remember spending hours on the driveway with, you know, the old fashioned boombox playing music and just working out my game and shooting. And, you know, nowadays you just, you know, you just don't see kids doing that in the same way anymore.
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, I remember, you know, my parents were split. And so, you know, my dad would go off to work and, you know, if grandma or grandpa couldn't pick me up from school, it was just, you know, go get the ball out of the locker and you stay in the gym until somebody showed up to pick you up, you know, so you could be there for 3.5 hours and, you know, you wouldn't even realize any time had elapsed because you were just in there kind of lost in your own world. And, you know, even moving on past just being a kid, like even all the way up to the college days, I mean, you just think about, you know, the times running on the track, you think about the times that, you know, you probably went home that night and your parents even looked at you like, what were you doing all day? And you were proud as could be about, you know, what you accomplished today, but nobody else understood it. And that was kind of fun.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that, you know, sort of that solo, you know, being out there on your own and kind of getting lost in your own world of the game of basketball was something that I found to be very attractive and something that I loved as a kid. When you were growing up, you know, in Hawaii, what was that? What was the basketball scene like at that time? You were there through eighth grade, correct?
Yes.
So what was that? What was the basketball scene like from a kid's perspective? Or where you probably weren't necessarily analyzing it at that point, but kind of looking back, you know, what was the basketball scene like in Hawaii back then?
Well, it's a very different game there. I mean, you know, not to make any generalizations or stereotypes, but there aren't as many big guys. You know, everybody, you know, kind of learns from the same school of teaching. You know, everybody goes to the same camps and clinics when they're little. So, you know, everyone's base is kind of the same. And I think this goes beyond basketball, but when you are in a small town, small environment, small state, it's easy once you're kind of pigeonholed into a certain role or into a certain level of expectation, it's hard to get out. So I remember, excuse me, being in seventh and eighth grade, you know, being kind of the shorter, underdeveloped, little chubby, you know, but probably the most dedicated guy out there. But I was nowhere near the seventh and eighth grade player that a lot of kids who had already peaked and reached physical maturity were at that time. So, you know, I really felt like it was hard to get out from under that shadow. And I don't think I would have, you know, probably been able to go on and do the things I did had I stayed. And that was a big part of my decision to leave. But, you know, I think the Hawaii game's gotten a lot better. There's a really big divide between what they call the ILH for basically the private schools and then the public school league. So, you know, I think that was always kind of the big rivalry in terms of getting a feel for what high school basketball is like there. It's always like the best in the private schools versus the best in the public schools, and it becomes a huge event. So it's a great following. You know, support is really good there, but I think the level of play is getting a lot better, but it wasn't quite, you know, where the rest of the mainland, as we call it, was back in the early 90s.
So do you still have connections out there that you talk to people that, you know, maybe you grew up with that are still out there in Hawaii?
Yes, my dad still lives out there. My sister, a bunch of family members still live out there. You know, and they casually kind of go to games. My uncle, who was actually the Hawaii State Coach of the Year in three separate sports, he's no longer a coach. He does college counseling for the high school. And so he kind of still keeps his ear to the ground on all that stuff. He coaches a girls AAU team. So yeah, I mean, I'm still pretty on top of what's going on out there. You know, dad sends me videos of every championship game and everything. I've got an idea who's who. And every time there's a walk-on at the University of Hawaii who ends up being good, he always reminds me that, you know, 3 years ago he told me to recruit the kid. And
there you go.
I feel bad.
Have you had kids from Hawaii come into your program?
I've had a kid commit but not get accepted. And I've had about three or four kids, you know, come down to us and like two other schools. So
it's going to happen one day.
I don't know. I think so. I think it will. I think just, you know, internet and all that kind of stuff, you know, we still, the attraction and the appeal of an East Coast high academic school, But not quite having to go all the way to the East Coast, I think, is going to pay off one day.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. So you are in Hawaii, and you end up after your eighth. Was it after your eighth grade year that you moved to California?
Yes.
All right. And so you got a modern day, which is obviously, for anybody who knows high school basketball, that's a huge powerhouse school out in California. So talk a little bit about what that was like, making the transition from Hawaii to modern day in California.
Yeah. So, kind of in short, my parents were separated for a while. So every summer I'd go visit my mom, and I'd go to modern day's basketball camps, and, just kind of being starstruck by some of the people I saw, not knowing who they were, just knowing that they were really good. And, I guess kind of probably shouldn't say this, but I approached my pre-ninth grade summer almost acting as if I was going to go to modern day, with having no intentions of even moving. played through the summer league and ended up having a really good month. And, they started talking to me about, the plans they had for me and this and that. And, here I was looking at eighth grade and being like the 15th man on my team back in Hawaii. And here's modern day telling me that, I can probably be something. So I made the move, obviously, for, family reasons at the age of, whatever that was, 13, 14 years old. It's pretty gut wrenching to have to make a decision like that. But, at the end of the day, having the opportunity to play at modern day was a big deal. My older stepbrother, who ended up playing in the NFL for a little while, he was at modern day. He's a year older than I am, and he had a great experience with it. So, I just sort of took a leap of faith and, ended up making the move and kind of jumping into it. As far as the experience goes, you can probably assume the end of this story, but once I got there, including myself, there ended up being, if I count correctly, there were 8 players just in my class that ended up being Division I players.
That's incredible.
Yeah. So, and I wasn't recruited in. I wasn't, I guess recruiting is not the right word, but, I wasn't through the feeder systems that they had in place. I was just kind of the guy who showed up. So, just like with any program, the walk-on almost makes the coach look bad, So,
right, right.
So I kind of, by the time my junior year hit, I guess I kind of understand that. And, obviously I had to make the move from there. But in my time at modern day, I learned a ton. I remember going into the ninth grade, I was in the gym in August, and I was just shooting around by myself again, kind of waiting for my mom to pick me up after work. And some guy who I knew was on the varsity team goes, "Hey, kid, you want to play one-on-one?" I was like, "Yeah, sure, let's do it." And I think it was like 15-1. And then, I lost. And, and then about a week later, I realized who it was. And it was a senior on the team. His name was Miles Simon, who ended up
playing. Nice. There you go.
Arizona being the most outstanding player of the NCAA tournament. So it was just pretty cool to be around, that type of expectation and having people around you that wouldn't accept anything but, being great.
Was that the first time that you sort of realized that, obviously, you were being challenged, but was that the first time that you started to think that, hey, maybe there's, a future, whether it's just, having tremendous success at the high school level, or, maybe I'm going to have a chance to go on and play in college? Had you had those dreams, those thoughts prior to that? Or was that kind of the first time, when you got to California, where you started to think, hey, maybe I have a chance to do something with this game?
It was definitely while I was in California that it became a real thing. I always followed, Chaminade and University of Hawaii and all that stuff when I was a little kid. But, there was such a disconnect between who I was and who they were. But once I got around, Miles and guys of that stature, and saw that they were doing the same things that I was doing. Obviously I wasn't blessed with some of those physical abilities and gifts, but, that's sort of when it came together. And I also wasn't aware how many schools were out there, until I moved out to California. So it was probably around the summer going into my sophomore year, I started traveling and doing the summer ball thing with modern day, and everywhere you went, there was a college, that you could eventually end up at. And, you look past the Rick Pitinos in the gym, you look past some of those guys, and then you see the, UC Irvines and, the Fresno States, Cal State Fullertons, et cetera. And that's when it sort of set in that, like, hey, there's got to be a level where I can continue playing.
And so you ended up transferring. Was that after your sophomore year that you transferred?
Yeah, it was actually a couple weeks into my junior year.
Okay, all right.
In the interest of time, I'll make the story quick. I met a guy at a basketball club, like a workout place, who was an assistant coach at Villa Park, where I ultimately transferred. But all the modern day guys went there to play. And so this guy had played overseas for a while. We were just shooting together one day by luck. And, started asking me who I was, where I was. And he's like, look, I'm not trying to get in your way and do whatever, but if ever it doesn't work out, like I coach at a school right in your backyard, just, reach out to me if ever, you need anything. And that was probably a year and a half prior to my move. Somehow the guys at Modern Day, they heard a different version of that story. And, I wasn't handled with gentle gloves at that point. So already 2 weeks into my junior year, I went into transfer, and, of course, the upper administration were also assistant basketball coaches. So the day of the deadline to make a transfer and still be allowed to play, I sat in an office for 3 hours waiting for somebody to sign my paper until finally another member of the coaching staff who was on the security team basically made the administrator come out and sign my papers. So I almost did not have a high school basketball career.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah. So.
Wow. Wow. And so then what's the experience like at Villa Park compared to modern day?
Villa Park was great. So Coach Reynolds, who's still the head coach there now, he had spent some time, he played at modern day. He had kind of dabbled in some other head coaching, like interim positions, but he kind of always eyed Villa Park. I was really fortunate. They had Eric Chenoweth, who ended up playing center at Kansas. He was my same class, 7'1" kid. So I walked right into, 7 assists a game just by showing up.
Hey, just throw the ball up near the rim.
Exactly.
Nice work, Isaiah.
Yeah, make a horrible play and just put it at the rim. So that was a great situation. I'll never forget sitting in my history class. I think it was week one, maybe the first or second day, and a bunch of the kids were sitting in the corner, and I was on my own. And, oh, yeah, I heard we got a transfer from modern day. I haven't seen him yet. Have you seen him? And clearly expecting something other than a 5'10" frame.
That's hilarious.
Sitting in the corner, just listening to them talk about it. And so I guess it was kind of funny once, I got to kind of build a camaraderie with those guys. They had not had a winning season in over 20 years. And, that it was nice to be able to just focus on, just winning and just getting a program right. Modern day is great, but it's very individual driven. And that's in no way a knock. I mean, it's just a different environment. Guys go to modern day so that they can, raise their draft stock at this point. I'm just trying to be a high school basketball player that has a significant role. And, if my role is to just help us get it to a winning record, I mean, that's something I can sink my teeth into. And that's kind of how it started.
So as you're going through and you're playing, so you played 2 seasons there, correct?
Yep.
All right. So at what point does the recruiting process start for you? And then what did that look like in terms of you ultimately making your decision to go to Yale? Obviously not a hard decision from a school standpoint, but what in terms of a basketball fit? And just describe what your recruiting process was like.
It was pretty slow. I mean, as a junior, obviously this is pre-internet. This is pre-YouTube. This is, back when we sent VHS copies and, you make 8 of them and you hope you pick one of the right schools to send it to. So junior year, I have an okay season. I think, by the numbers, it was better than most, but nothing spectacular. I started sending out some videos and a couple unofficial visits to local schools. But so back then, those sneaker companies were always trying to get the best players to go to their top camp, Nike camp, Adidas camp. So Adidas actually invited me to camp to try to get my teammate to go.
Nice. There you go.
Big loss for Adidas. They got me, but Eric chose the Nike camp. So ended up having a partial tear in my Achilles in the summer. And so I ended up sitting out. And as I was trying to get myself back in shape, I had to miss the Adidas camp. And so by chance, just trying to play my way back into shape, I went to another event with my high school. And that's where Yale was recruiting a kid I was playing against in that game. And I don't really remember a ton of that specific game, but obviously I did well enough. And they started following me around for the summer. Again, without the information being at your fingertips back in the mid-90s, my list was weird. It was like Air Force, Montana, Yale. I mean, schools had nothing in common with one another, but once Yale took me on the visit and basically, said, hey, if you commit to us, you're the guy. And, we just need to know, within a reasonable time so we can stop recruiting other people. And, it wasn't a really hard sell, as you said. You get a chance to go to one of the best schools in the entire world, and you know, they want you to run their team at some point down the road. It's a pretty easy yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to focus on two things here in terms of the transition from high school to college. Let's focus on the academic side of it first and just talk a little bit about what that adjustment was like going from high school to the academic course load and workload that you had when you got to Yale.
I felt like I was just kind of alone at Yale because everybody, my roommates, even some of my teammates, I mean, I'll never forget, we played pickup. And, you know, when one of the juniors, when his team lost, he went off to the side and started reading. I couldn't fathom.
Never saw that one before.
No, neither had I. And so, clearly just in conversations with the other students, I wasn't the same type of personality. And I was okay with that. But it was more of a social adjustment than academic. I think the biggest academic adjustment is probably across the board for, you know, any kid going from high school to college. Just, it's not a constant homework. It's okay, you have three tests to prove yourself, and if you mess one of them up, it's going to be tough. I think that's, I had that first tough exam, and then all of a sudden practices hit full swing and you get a little bit panicked. But once I got through that first semester and I kind of found out that, you know, there were still people that were a little bit more similar to me in terms of just how they approach school in general, I was able to fit in.
Was there an East Coast, West Coast adjustment?
Yeah. I think the personality of, you know, New York, Boston, all that kind of, I had not been around that before. And there were a lot of kids from those areas at Yale. So I think, you know, again, that kind of went to just more of the social adjustment, in terms of like being on the West Coast and moving to the East Coast. That wasn't as bad. I mean, I was okay with the snow and, you know, I took my one big fall on the ice for the first time, and then I was good. I figured it out. but to be honest, that was not really a huge adjustment, especially since I didn't have a car anyway.
Gotcha. All right. So on the basketball side, going from high school to college basketball, what would you say as a player, what was the biggest adjustment? What was the biggest challenge that you faced that first year coming in as a freshman in terms of the basketball side of things?
Yeah, it's a tough question. I think the hardest part, I shot a horrible percentage that year. And I just remember thinking that anything that I went into the game thinking about for me as an individual just went out the window as soon as I got on the floor. The speed, you know, was so much greater. You just really have to simplify everything you do. You know, in high school, you're asked to rebound, you're asked to defend, you're asked to, you know, create shots for other people. You know, once you get to college, especially as a freshman, I think you just need to figure out what one or two things you're capable of doing and just start there. And I think that's something I wasn't quite ready for. It didn't help that my first college game was at UConn the year before they won the national championship. And I think I played like 26 or 27 minutes, and I don't think I had a stat.
Welcome to college basketball.
Exactly. Well, it took me about two or three games. And, you know, the whole time I'm like, man, am I good enough to be here? Like, if everybody's like this, I don't belong. So, you know, it took a little bit of an adjustment period, but, you know, I think the transition is really just knowing and understanding what you're best at, starting there. And then when teams adjust you, then you can start to diversify, but you just really can't come in thinking you're going to be an all around do it all type of player.
That's one of the biggest challenges that I saw for guys around me. And it was a challenge that, you know, I had to face when I went in and figure out, well, how am I going to get myself onto the floor? And as a freshman, I played very little. I probably played, and I bet I averaged 6 minutes a game maybe over the course of my freshman year. But through that year, I was able to sort of persevere and figure out, you know, what do I need to make myself stick here and to contribute to my team to help them win. And I think that's people take that for granted, that mental adjustment of figuring out what it is that I need to do, because the high school game and the college game are so different.
Yeah, no, I think it's tough. I think to add to that, I replaced a senior starter when I first got there. You know, so you have the dynamic there to work out just within the locker room, you know, and so I think those are things that maybe, you know, in high school, you don't just play your seniors or play your upperclassmen. Usually there's a physical difference, you know, and there's a reason, you know, versus kind of the situation walking into college, everybody's pretty much, you know, at that point a young man, and you know, it's there are a lot of opinions and a lot of conflicts at times. So, you know, I think when I first got there, my thinking was I need to prove that I'm at this level. And then once I sort of hit some of those struggles, it was like, okay, I need to prove that these guys are going to want to play with me. And I need to just really focus on trying to make the game easier for these guys. And, you know, statistically, I'm clearly not going to make a huge impact. And that's fine. I never, you know, played for stats. It was, you know, how are we going to win? And I think it's, how can I make the seniors be better? You know, how can I make the juniors be better? Guys who have been here and done this before, you know, what is it that they were missing over the last couple of years in that position? And so I think that was really what, you know, I had that sit down with my coach at the time. And, you know, I just really talked about, you know, hey, I want you to really help me with this because I've never been in a role where, you know, I'm clearly the sixth option on a 5-man floor. So I like it. You know, so I think I averaged 2 points a game, and, you know, but our leading scoring guard used to play the point. He never had to bring the ball up. He never had to guard the best player. You know, I took all those responsibilities from him so he could be better. And I felt like that was kind of my first step to learning, you know, how I can impact the game without, you know, putting up a stat.
How challenging was it building relationships with those upperclassmen, the guys that had been in the program before? Did you find that when you're coming in as the freshman and the new guy and people have been there before, how long did it take for you to sort of integrate yourself with them and build the kinds of relationships that you needed in order to be successful as teammates?
I think it took a little while with the seniors. To be honest, well, I got hurt in my fifth game and I ended up missing like six games from there. And I think at that point I got to just kind of hang out with them as just another guy, as opposed to, you know, another guard competing for minutes at their spot. And, you know, I think that actually helped me. It helped me kind of get to know them. It kind of allowed me to kind of drop my guard and them to drop theirs a little bit. So I think it took about, you know, 8-10 games into the season. There were a handful of guys that were also from California that just sort of wanted to help me out as a student there first. And so I think that helped me feel comfortable right away. And then once the basketball piece started to settle in, it wasn't too terrible. You know, as far as like the upperclassmen, there was also a lot of turnover that year. We lost a couple guys. Guys had opportunities, you know, typical Ivy League stuff to do internships or
right.
Do something else, you know, where they knew they weren't going to commit their summers to working on their games. So they left. You know, so I think just some of that constant moving also, you know, made people realize they needed each other more. So, but no, it was good. And I think once I came back from that injury and I had a little bit of a different perspective on things, I think it went really well.
What's your favorite memory from your time at Yale? What did you love the most about getting an opportunity to play there as a college basketball player?
So when I started my freshman year, I had five roommates and the gym was so empty that they had the whole behind the basket section and they just became known as like Isaiah's crazy roommates.
That's awesome.
They'd wear the tank tops and run back and forth and the other guys were shooting free throws. And I mean, just, you know, really, really ridiculous stuff. To my senior year, you know, the last two games of the season against Penn and Princeton, who were the two best teams in the league at the time. We mathematically still had a chance. We realistically didn't. You know, but the gym was absolutely packed. And I think just that transition and everything that went into that, you know, we went through a 4-22 season my sophomore year. You know, Coach Jones came in my junior year. We sort of rebooted everything. I missed my whole junior year because I had the three knee surgeries, and still being able to get back on the court for my senior year was really, really big for me. You know, I can understand getting beat out or losing a position, but you know, I wasn't going to let injury do it. And so then to get back in the starting lineup and have my senior day with a packed gym was really special.
Yeah, that's exciting to be able to, you know, go through some of those trials and tribulations that you went through and then to, you know, end up on top. I think that one of the things that always struck me as, you know, as a college basketball player was just the opportunity to play in big games where you did have a big crowd. And, you know, obviously I was at Kent, we didn't always have big crowds for every game, but, you know, there were games where, you know, we'd have 5,000, 5,500 people and at the game. And those were some of my best memories, getting a chance to play in front of, you know, a full house. And I cherish those times and those big games that you got an opportunity to play in, because not everybody gets a chance to do that. And so it's great that, you know, you went from a situation where, you know, you're not winning and the crowds aren't there, to have an opportunity in your senior year to be able to experience, you know, those crowds. And those are things that, you know, I think if you look back, and, you know, certainly as I do, that those have got to be some of the best memories of basketball, simply because of the excitement that was generated by the crowd. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it starts off just kind of being your friends, and then it becomes, you know, somebody else that lives in your dorm. And next thing you know, you see a professor, and then, you know, after that, you just start seeing, you know, people that you cross, you know, in downtown New Haven, or, you know, in your case, in downtown Kent, that, you know, just you start to realize that when there's something that people, you know, really kind of gravitate towards, it's really special, because you don't see that kind of stuff every day.
Yeah, that they care about it. It's always, you know, you're kind of insulated in your own world, and you're going through, and, you know, you're at practice, mm-hmm. and you're part of the team, and, you know, you kind of, you know, you have your little inner circle, and you don't always realize, at least I know I didn't, that, you know, there are these greater, you know, people out there, whether it's people in the community, whether it's other students that, you know, you don't know them, but they feel like they know you simply because they've, you know, watched you in a game or whatever it might be. And that was always one of the things that struck me, is there would be people that would, you know, walk up and strike up a conversation and start talking about something, and you're looking at them going, I have no idea who you are, and, you know, I appreciate you talking to me about this, but it's a little strange. And so I can't even imagine what it's like for, you know, people who are legitimately famous.
Yeah, that's got to be crazy. I see why they all have those gigantic homes, and they order everything for them in the house.
Yeah, I can't even imagine what it's like. I've told this story, I think, once before on the podcast, but I had a chance when I was in college to work at Michael Jordan's basketball camp. And the big disappointment the week I was there was that Jordan, usually he played with the college guys.
Yeah.
And so that was one of the things that I was obviously most looking forward to, was just being having a chance to get out on the court. But the week that I was there, supposedly he was out gambling with Mike Ditka the night that he was supposed to play. That was the rumor. That was the rumor that went buzzing through the camp staff and all the, you know, all the college guys, was that that's where he was. But kind of the point that I was going to make about, you know, them being famous is, I remember the first time that Jordan came to the camp, the week I was there, I think it was the first day of camp, he showed up and he parked his car, like, right. It was at Elmhurst College in Illinois. Yep. And parked his car right in front of the gym. There was, like, a, you know, whatever, a little driveway there. And so the driveway was 20 feet from the front entrance to the gym. And he just left his car there. And obviously, as he pulled up, everybody, you know, was running out there. People are, you know, out there to see him. And he went in the gym. And while he was in the gym, people just stood around his car, like 10 deep around his car, having no idea how long he was going to actually be in the gym, waiting for him to come back out, just so he'd kind of, you know, he'd have to walk through them in order to get back to the car. And it's, you know, you kind of take for granted the freedoms that we all have as somebody that nobody really cares about, you know, when we walk down the street. And, you know, for a guy like Jordan, who no matter where he goes, no matter what the situation is, that's what his life is like. And I can't even imagine that. Cause like I said, the number of people that, you know, came up to me as a Kent State basketball player just in that time when I was there, seemed larger than what it should have been. And so I can't imagine what an NBA guy or a guy like Jordan, who's an icon, goes through on a daily basis.
Yeah, that's got to be like in your own little prison, but with a lot of money.
Yeah, exactly. Right, exactly. You get some perks to go along with that. So
exactly.
in order to put up with that, you get paid pretty handsomely to be Michael Jordan. So I don't think he has any complaints.
Yeah, no, I tried it for a day.
Yeah, there you go. I agree. I'd just like to dunk like him for one, you know, one day. I'd like to know what it's like to be able to just jump like that.
Mike does jump well. He jumps and touches the net real nicely.
Yeah, I can get the net. I can still get the net. So things are good for me. Yeah, exactly.
Registration is now open at www.headstartbasketball.com for this summer's Head Start Basketball Camps. We'll be hosting camps this summer in Strongsville, Westlake, Avon Lake, Oberlin, Brunswick, Highland Heights, Mentor, and Hudson. At Head Start Basketball, we care deeply about making a positive impact on the lives of young basketball players, both on and off the court.
It's through building strong relationships with our players, parents, and coaching staff that we are able to use the game of basketball to enrich the lives of those we interact with, both inside and outside of our organization. We believe that our attention to detail, our growth mindset, and our commitment to lifelong learning allows us to help our players achieve their fullest potential. We are passionately committed to providing players, parents, and coaches with everything they need to reach their goals. These core values run through everything we do. Check out our website, www.headstartbasketball.com, and discover why you should attend a Head Start basketball camp this summer. Hope to see you there.
So while you're at Yale, are you ever thinking about coaching at that point? Obviously, you went and got your GA job at OU, but did you always know that you wanted to coach, or was that something that, you know, when you graduated, you kind of looked around, you're like, man, I want to stay involved in the game? Or how did it come to be that you got into coaching?
I knew I wasn't going to be able to completely give up basketball. I mean, it's just been such a major part of my life. So coaching hadn't really crossed my mind. So my junior year, I missed basically the whole season with the knee injuries. And so, you know, I'm with the team. I'm doing everything. I'm just trying to, you know, absorb as much of it as I can. And that's when it kind of hit me that maybe that was an option. And then senior year, once I got back to playing, I actually graduated with one more year of eligibility, so I was going to try and continue playing after. But at that point, my coaches actually approached me and said, hey, you know, what are your thoughts? Like, you know, I think you maybe, you might like this. You might actually end up being halfway decent at it. So, you know, do you want me to try to help you get in the door? And my initial response was no. I kind of wanted to go make money. I spent all that time at Yale. I'm supposed to get rich.
Right, exactly. You don't want to be a bat. You don't want to be a basketball coach after you go to Yale. Come on.
What are Yale for?
Yeah, you're throwing away that 4 years of Yale education.
Exactly, right? Economics degree, the whole deal, and I'm coaching hoops. So, but no. So they hooked me up with Coach O'Shea at Ohio University. He was going into his first year. Coach Jones had just come from Ohio University for 2 years there, and before, you know, coming back to us at Yale and coming in as the head coach. So he made a few phone calls, and next thing you know, I'm a Bobcat. And that was kind of when I realized that, like, this is kind of a fun profession. You're around people that have the same interests as you. I mean, you think about all the different jobs out there that you go to work and nobody's actually thinking about the same thing. Nobody has the same interests. You're just passing in the hallways. And, you know, I found an environment that was just so much fun to be around people that were like-minded and, you know, competitive, but, you know, supportive at the same time. It was a fun culture to be in.
So what did you like about being a graduate assistant? I know, like, I think back to the guys that were GAs when I was at Kent, and, you know, they were all, I loved every one of the guys that we had as a graduate assistant, and just, you know, the energy that they brought, mostly obviously as young coaches. So what do you remember about that time? What was the most enjoyable piece of being a GA there at OU?
I like kind of just learning the behind the scenes things. I liked, it was a new staff, obviously. So everybody was sort of feeling each other out. So I didn't feel like the new guy trying to fit into an established staff. Getting to, I don't know if these names are common to listeners, but John Rhodes is a, you know, Ohio University graduate and been in the state for a long time coaching and playing. So he was on staff, and another guy by the name of Gary Manchell, who had coached in the Ivy League and was in Division II for a long time on the East Coast. Those were the primary assistants. And then Kevin Kuick, who was my roommate also. But those guys all brought such a different perspective to basketball. And, you know, when you come up as a player, you only really know what you're taught. And now to hear four different opinions of, hey, this is how we did it at multiple places. And I mean, it just really opened my mind to, like, you know, wow, this is really a blank canvas. You can do whatever you want. And, you know, that's when I really thought that the collaboration side was really neat. And then as far as, you know, kind of the grunt work, as I guess they called it, I mean, I never really saw an issue with that because you're around other college athletes and you saw a little bit of yourself in each of them. And, you know, you felt like you had something to offer. It was kind of hard when some of them were actually older than I was, but you know, you at least saw the role that down the road, if you stay in coaching, you can fill.
What surprised you about going from being a player to being a coach? Because obviously as a player, you're kind of insulated from sort of the backstory of what's going on behind the scenes with the coaching staff. So what was surprising to you that maybe you didn't realize how much time the coaches spent on something or something that they had to do that you didn't realize as a player?
I think I didn't quite realize how much assistant coaches were involved. At least that's how it was, you know, at Ohio. And then also when I went back to Yale, you know, I think just like with probably most coaching staffs, you know, you only have 2 hours or so with your team and you kind of want to hear one voice. So everything's consistent. You know, but I think the input and just the back and forth, you know, I didn't realize how much swing there was in the office. I mean, you could walk in the office and, you know, we think we're going to play man on this particular day and this guy's going to guard that guy. And you walk out of that meeting 45 minutes later and you're playing 2-3 zone. You know, I felt like as a player, it was so easy. You know, everything coaches gave you was just so concise and to the point and easy to digest as a player. You just don't realize how many things are put up on the table before a decision gets made.
Yeah, I know that's one of the things that, you know, we've talked to some other guys, you know, primarily high school coaches about sort of the need to have assistants when you're the head coach that will disagree with you and challenge you and make sure that all the relevant ideas are getting on the table. And then once you emerge from the coach's office, then to your point with players, it's a united front and you're giving the players, this is what we're going to do. And players don't always realize all the debate that went into that behind the scenes. And I think the amount of time that coaches put in, I think that's one of the things that if I look back on my time playing, whether it's in high school or college, I think you take for granted the amount of time that coaches put in to planning practices, to planning strategy, to scouting, all that stuff. You kind of take it for granted as a player. Yep. And you realize after the fact that, man, those guys were putting in a lot of time to help us be successful. And I think players take that for granted sometimes.
Yeah, definitely. And I also think that, you know, being around when I was at Ohio and at Yale, you know, these were, you know, family guys and, you know, there's just such a sacrifice that, you know, I think as a player, you just always expect your coach to be there on call.
Yeah, exactly. I think that the family situation is one of the things like I've told people nowadays that, you know, if I was a high school athletic director, in a lot of ways, if I was hiring, I'd want to hire somebody who was, you know, under 30 and single or somebody who was over 55 and retired and all their kids were gone. Because I think if you have young kids and you have a family, I think it's just, you know, especially today, the demands that are placed on, you know, a coach, whether it's at the high school level or obviously at, you know, the college level where you are, you know, there's just a tremendous amount of demands being placed on coaches today. And it's a challenge. It's definitely a challenge for everyone when it comes to balancing your work and your coaching with your family.
Yeah. No, it's definitely good to integrate the two. You know, it's dangerous at times, you know, you feel like you're putting them out there a little bit, but, you know, I think, just being open and honest about your own values, you know, I think that's kind of the way to go.
Yeah. I think it's a challenge. I think if you don't do that and you try to separate them completely, I just don't think there's any way to be able to balance it. So after you get done at Yale, you decide that you're going to leave and, leave coaching. So what prompted that decision? And then how long were you out? And then what made you want to get back in? So I guess there's a bunch of questions in there.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, long story short, I basically got tired of being broke. You know, so in the Ivy League, the third assistant is not allowed to be salaried. And so, you know, basically it's a glorified volunteer job. So
right.
I'm working at Staples. I'm working at the local burrito shop. I'm doing all kinds of things just to sort of help, you know, supplement whatever I've saved up and try to make a living out of it. Around, you know, late season, I kind of thought to myself, like, all right, this was fun while it lasted. I gave it a shot. So I moved back to California, stayed with my mom and my wife now. She was my girlfriend at the time. She came out to California with me. We decided we were going to just try and make it work out there. It took about 4 months into my financial analyst job to just kind of realize, like, you know, I sit in the cubicle for 8 hours a day and, you know, it's like the movie Office Space. I do about 15 minutes of work and I'm just
pulling my thumbs. You have a red stapler?
I should have. If I had stayed long enough, I'd have gotten one. you know, and all I was doing was looking up basketball stuff. And that's when I sort of realized, like, I'm not the type of person who can, part of my job was like setting sales goals and doing the demographic searches on where to open new stores for our company. And, you know, I didn't like being the reporter. I wanted to be the guy doing it. And so I just figured, let's give this one more try. And this is my wife's line of work. She can pretty much be anywhere, but you know, she's from Ohio. So I told her, like, hey, I'm going to apply for any and every position that's open at the college level in Ohio. And, you know, we'll move back and we'll start over. And, you know, if I make it, I make it. If I don't, you know, I can sit in a cubicle in Ohio. So, but that's how I kind of got back into it. And the John Carroll women's staff gave me my first crack. So I was, I think, making $2,000 for that season and back to flipping pizzas and doing things like that just to get.
So you're saying it's not all glamour? Is that what you're saying here?
Surprisingly, it's not. I think my first 3 years, including my stipend at Ohio, I made a total of $7,000 in coaching.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, I think that's one of the things that I think the people who are outside of the game of basketball, you know, everybody sees the huge salaries that, you know, John Calipari makes, that Roy Williams makes, that, you know, the notoriety that Mike Krzyzewski has. And, you know, they forget that even guys who are assistants on the Division One level, you know, the lifestyle and the amount of time that you put in and, you know, the amount of money that you can make, especially as an entry level position, it's tough. And the guys who end up getting to those, you know, those high levels and even, you know, get to be a head coach on the college level, the amount of dues that you have to pay in order to make that happen, I think people take that for granted because they only see the glamour of the, you know, of the tournament, the Final Four and all those things. And they forget about the hard work that went into getting guys into the positions where they are. And some guys put in all that time and they never get to those positions.
Yeah, it's very true. There's a lot of great coaches out there that never get the opportunity to show it on a bigger stage. And I'm sure you're the same way. I'm sure anybody who's been in it long enough, you know, and you ask some of your biggest influences, you know, obviously the easy names pop up. You think about your head coaches, but you know, there's probably eight or 10 guys that, you know, pop up in my mind right away as, you know, boy, that coach or that mentor really opened my mind to something or taught me something or made me think a different way. And, you know, those guys, sometimes they don't want the chance too, you know, I mean, it's kind of like the,
right,
the football
exactly.
thing we've been through with the Browns. Some guys are better as coordinators and some guys are better as head coaches, but yeah, some of the best ones, you never even hear their names.
Yeah, I would agree with that. We had a chance to talk to John Searby, who helps run the J. Billis Skills Academy down in North Carolina. And he talked about how basically they staff their entire camp with Division III head coaches because of the NCAA rules that, you know, prevent D1 and D2 coaches from being able to do that. And, you know, he said that Jay consistently says that, you know, these guys are some of the best minds in the game of basketball, that, you know, they can outcoach guys that he sees in the ACC and the Big Ten. Mm-hmm. And again, they're all people that nobody's ever heard of.
Right.
And I think it just goes to show you that a lot of times you find your place as a basketball coach. And for some people that may end up being a great high school coach, for some people that may end up being a Division I coach, for some people that may end up being somebody who coaches a fifth grade team and is just great with kids who are in elementary school. And everybody has to find their niche and find the place that fits them. And you can find great coaches everywhere. And, you know, I'm sure just like you're aware of, you can find bad coaches at every level that, you know, don't do the things that, you know, that maybe they should be doing. So talk a little bit about what it was like to coach on the girls' side. Cause I'm assuming that was the first time that you had coached women. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was. It was interesting. You know, obviously it's, you know, the elephant in the room. I'm a 26 year old, you know, guy and coaching 22-year-old women, like it's
right.
Kind of a weird dynamic there. And I was probably more uncomfortable than they were. I'm sure they've had, you know, male coaches off and on their entire lives. So once I got over that, I actually really enjoyed that year. I felt like, you know how it is, you walk in a gym and everybody's kind of sizing each other up. I felt like that went away, you know, when I walked into a women's practice.
Yeah.
You know, I was able to just coach and have fun with it. The level, I tell this to a lot of people, you know, about the Division III, Division I, you know, but it's even more prevalent in women to men. The difference in athleticism and size between, you know, the least athletic woman on the floor and the most athletic woman is not anywhere near as great a difference as it is on the men's side, if that made any sense.
No, it made total sense.
So, yeah, so like the little things that you know, you teach, there's a better chance of it showing up in terms of, you know, success than on the men's side. You can teach somebody to drop step, seal, hold the position, you know, and a 6'7" athlete who can touch 11 and a half feet still steals the pass.
It's going to block, right? Or it's going to block it anyway.
Exactly. You know, but on the women's side, I felt like there was a lot more room to help with like an immediate view of success. Hey, let's do this. Let's try it this way. And you couldn't just get, you know, I don't know what the word is. Here's my Yale degree coming out, you know, out athlete, you know, somebody.
Right. Yeah.
You know, or just be, you know, so physically dominant over somebody. So I felt like in a short period of time, only being there one season, I felt like that was the first time I really saw just how much coaching can help and just how much kids want to be coached.
Yeah, I think on the girls' side, one of the things I found interesting is, you know, I have two daughters, and my oldest daughter's a freshman and my youngest daughter's in third grade. And so for a long time, my older daughter, up through like fifth grade, she had played rec basketball. And so that's obviously sort of a different animal where, you know, you have kids who have all different levels of seriousness and whatever. And so I, you know, there's a limit to, you know, how much coaching you're doing at that, you know, at that particular level. You're trying to, you know, teach them a few things and have fun and whatever. Mm-hmm. But eventually my daughter started playing, again, not at a super high level, but we played some travel. We played some AAU by the time she got to sixth grade. And now she's had sort of the same AAU team. This will be our third year together. And it's just a great group of girls that we have that all get along. And I've had as much fun, if not more fun, coaching them simply because of the bond that they've been able to develop. And these are all girls from different schools that they're probably as good of friends as, you know, the girls that, you know, they all go to school with on a daily basis. And so that's the part that, you know, that I've really enjoyed, is seeing them blossom and their friendships. And that's kind of the piece of it that I've really enjoyed with coaching the girls that I don't think you always get on the boys' side, where, to your point, everybody's kind of sizing each other up, and there's more of a mano-a-mano individual rivalry within the team. Whereas if you build a girls team correctly, I think that they bond together in a way that maybe the boys don't.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And I think the neat part about, you know, being at John Carroll was, you know, and obviously I guess kind of fast forward to my experiences here at Oberlin, you know, all the kids come from roughly the same area. So once they kind of broke down the barriers of, oh yeah, I saw you at that high school, or, you know, I remember seeing you at that AAU event. They have stories and things to sort of reference to show their similarities. But it only took, you know, probably a month or so to break down whatever. Oh, I don't like you because you followed me back in.
Right.
You know, really, really, really quickly. And, you know, once they got working together, and, you know, I think they improved a lot that year. And yeah, it was definitely a fun experience.
So then how does the opportunity arise for you to get to Oberlin?
So I was kicking the tires on, you know, as many men's jobs as I could. And I guess we'll play connect the dots here. So my boss at Ohio University, Tim O'Shea, he played at Boston College. And then the head coach at Oberlin played at Villanova. And so they had known each other. They had been friends for a long time. Well, the head coach at Oberlin was also the head coach at Brown when I was playing at Yale. So Happy Dobbs was the head coach at Oberlin. When he was looking for an assistant, you know, my old boss at Ohio, Tim O'Shea, called him. Hey, I got a guy who's in the Ivy League. I know Oberlin's a, you know, very high academic school. This might be a fit. You know, when Happy saw my name, he at least told me he remembered me. He probably did.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, told me I was a good player, but you know, I probably didn't make scouting report. but no, so he and I had competed against each other as player coach, and so Tim kind of connected us, and I came up here. I liked it. I liked the idea of the school. I think there's a lot of really great values at Oberlin that are sort of in line with the things that I find important, and so that's how we got started.
You get the opportunity after being an assistant, and you become the head coach. Talk about the transition from being an assistant coach for your career, and then you get an opportunity to take over the head job. what were some of the biggest adjustments you had to make that first year from being an assistant to being a head coach?
It's at the time, I really, if you had asked me that at the time, I wouldn't have known what to answer. In hindsight, I definitely didn't answer. I didn't do these things the first year, but I needed to just, you know, more than anything, I needed to view myself differently. I needed to sort of change. I was always big on, I wanted to make sure my assistant coaches, my players all had a say in what was going on, because I felt like that was important to me as a player and as an assistant. Whether or not I went with the suggestion, you know, was a separate story. But I mean, that was always my biggest focus. And I think I probably, you know, when you transition from being the assistant, you were doing that already. And I think I put too much of an emphasis on that piece. So I think, you know, it took a little time for me to really establish what I wanted. And, you know, the hard part about being a young head coach, I think I took over at 27, 28, something like that. You know, aside from just being, you know, almost the age of your players, I think the hard part is you can be doing the right things. You can be establishing the culture, establishing the way you want to play. You can be doing everything absolutely right, but still lose. And I think that was something that I didn't handle well. You know, I think we had a couple wins in the first five or six games. You know, I thought we were turning things around. You know, then we start playing teams that are just better than we are. And I don't think I knew how to handle, you know, when, hey, we're doing everything right, but we're not winning. Now what?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah.
I think I didn't have the confidence in myself yet. And I guess that's what I mean when I say I needed to view myself differently. I needed to just trust that what I believed was right, whether it was or wasn't, didn't matter. My players needed to know that I felt like it was right. And it took me a while to make that adjustment, but I think I did eventually.
Yeah, and I think there, in that case, I'm guessing that, you know, when you're having those feelings and those thoughts, you know, you want to make sure that you're conveying to your players the conviction that, hey, what we're doing is the right thing, even though we're not, you know, seeing that success on the scoreboard. And that's something that I think is difficult for a coach to be able to convey to players, because obviously, you know, it ends up being a bottom line. Wins and losses is how you get judged, rightfully or not. And players, I think, feel the same way, is, you know, hey, we're not winning. Why aren't we trying something different? And, you know, sometimes, like you said, you can be doing everything right and just get out talented. And that's where I think one of the things that, at least from my perspective, that has changed with basketball and with coaching, and maybe it's just a better education for us as coaches, is, you know, there's been a much bigger emphasis on looking at the process as opposed to looking at the outcome. And I think that's something that if you go back probably to the time, you know, when you started at Oberlin, or certainly back to the time when you were playing, I don't think there was as much of that process focus as there was, hey, we need to get this outcome, and, you know, not really focusing in on how you get to that outcome. And so I think nowadays more people are aware of the fact that we have to go through a certain process in order to have whatever success that we want to have. And it's possible that we can be having success with a lot of the things that we're doing through our process and maybe not have it turn out into a win in the scoreboard.
Yeah, I think so. And I think to kind of even go deeper in that, I think the hard part about process is a lot of times that's viewed exclusively as an individual thing. You know, I'm going to develop my game. I'm going to develop my body. I'm going to improve this aspect of what I can bring to the table offensively. It's even harder to trust process when it's team related. You know, I'm going to force the ball baseline. We're going to send the baseline help. We're going to cover down, and you forced a tough shot. You were in blockout position. They back tapped it and they stuck a three, you know?
Right. But, right.
And I think that's even because it's not just you and it's not something that you exclusively control. It's even harder to trust process when it involves the whole team. And I think that's where you can talk a kid into continuing. You can prove to a kid that he or she is getting better on an individual basis, but you can't always get full buy-in that the team is getting better, trusting process when it isn't showing results. And I think that's the challenge for all of us coaches.
Yeah. How do you go about doing that? What do you do in order to try to sell that, for lack of a better way of saying it? How do you sell that to your kids that, hey, we're doing the right things. We got to keep grinding at this and keep working at it. And eventually the results are going to pay off in wins and losses.
I really like, and I know it frustrates the heck out of people watching the live streams and whatever, but I like those games where you can't see the score. And so we'll sit and we'll watch a game and, you know, you kind of get a feel for, you know, either your opponent or yourself, whether or not you're playing well and whether or not you're playing poorly. And then they flash the score and it's totally not what you expected, you know? So I try to take that, even if there's a score on the screen, I'll cover it, I'll block it or manipulate the camera however I need to. And we'll just do a percentage of how many good possessions there were. And I think that's sort of helped us to understand, you know, controlling what we can control. And it also gives them a sense of, you know, I value more than just scoring. You know, I think, you know, we as coaches preach, do all the other things, you know, but stars are made by scoring 30 points. So I think sometimes your players need to see that that's how you really view basketball too, in order to really buy in.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's one of the things that as a coach, you have to make sure that you're letting kids know that it's more than just scoring points. It, there's other things that add value on the floor. And when you do that, I think you can send that message and you can get kids to buy into it, but you have to send that message to them on a daily basis, over and over again, in order for them to believe it. Because when they leave your practice or when they leave your game, everybody that's talking to them, let's face it, what's the first question that their mom or their dad or their roommate or their girlfriend is asking them is, how many points you score?
Yep.
And, you know, that's the first question. So it's hard as a player to get out of that mentality and be able to answer that question with, well, I scored two, but man, I played lockdown defense and I was the best box out guy. And, you know, I forced seven guys baseline and, you know, our defensive efficiency rating was this when I was on the floor. It's hard to be able to sell that to people, you know, as a player. And so as a coach, you've got to really, I think, be mindful of the way that you present, you know, those things that you're asking those kids to do.
Yeah. And I know you saw us play a game this year too, but, you know, we did it for a bunch of years. I got away from it and just now coming back to it. But, you know, we kind of play a defensive style that, you know, it's not about, you know, you having to lock up him. It's, the ball needs to go here. Somebody needs to cover this. Somebody else needs to cover that. So it's completely, you know, dependent on one another. And I think that's, it's ugly when it's not game ready.
Right.
And you really test the resolve of your kids and you really kind of get a feel for, you know, when things get difficult. And you can see it in practice. You already know what's coming in games. When things get difficult, who's going to problem solve and, you know, who's going to kind of look like a deer in headlights? And, you know, hopefully you don't have any of these guys, but, you know, some worst cases, you know, who's going to point fingers? You know, and I think that's where, you know, the way you approach practice, the way you approach video sessions, you know, making it about team process just has to be a consistent message.
Yeah, that culture, I think, is key, and the consistency is key. And I think accountability is key in all those situations where the kids know that when you say something that it's going to get done and you're going to expect it from everybody. And, you know, as long as they continue to hear that consistent message, it makes it easier for them to buy in. I think sometimes when you see inconsistencies and what's expected, whether that's from player to player or just from day to day, I think that's where coaches sometimes run into trouble because kids don't necessarily buy in when they don't know what's coming. I think that consistency is really, really key. Can you talk a little bit about what are your biggest challenges coaching at Oberlin?
Yeah, I think you know, the culture of college searching is different than it was even just, you know, 15, 20 years ago. The challenges, I guess, on the surface, academically, it's very, very selective. You know, I believe we're still either tied or the highest ranked academic school in Ohio. I think our average ACT score is something like, you know, I don't know, 31 or something like that. So in terms of just finding kids who are not only capable, but, you know, excited about taking on an academic challenge, you know, is obviously tough. I also think there's, I guess, a little bit of a stigma around Oberlin, especially locally, you know, because of the Conservatory of Music, because of everything it stood for. you know, culturally and, you know, over history. It's a little bit more of a liberal place, I think. It definitely gets a more liberal reputation than probably what it actually is. And it carries a negative connotation, I think, sometimes when I don't think that's fair. You know, and then obviously financial aid. I mean, we are fortunate that we meet 100% of demonstrated need. You know, but sticker price can scare the heck out of you. So
yeah,
exactly. I think those are challenges. Yep. I also feel like, you know, the biggest one for me specifically to basketball, there is such an emphasis on Division III basketball in this area. And with all the teams having such, you know, great success, being cheaper, being easier to get accepted into, it's just easy to cross us off early. And having so many options, you know, realistically, are you going to be able to go head to head with people and get the guys you want? So, you know, if you've looked at our roster, we have 9 California guys, we have 1 kid from Ohio. You know, so the challenges have evolved to now I've accepted the fact that, you know, everything we do recruiting wise is out of state. You know, but the environment or where you see the kids play when you evaluate them and you recruit them isn't the same as going to 7 high school games over the course of their senior season. It's just hard. You know, you see a guy in a camp for 20 minutes with an AAU team or with a team that got slapped together at a prospect showcase. And you're being asked to make judgment calls on who you want to incorporate into your 15 to 20 man family, based on just that. So,
yeah, that's gotta be tremendously challenging. I think, you know, that's certainly is a huge challenge. You know, how do you evaluate in those, you know, in those summer periods and try to figure out, again, how does a kid fit into, you know, his team system versus, you're seeing him in an AAU, which is, you know, basically in a lot of cases, a glorified pickup basketball situation, as opposed to a more structured, you know, high school situation, which is obviously what they're going to see when they get to college. And I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I would guess that one of the biggest challenges, irrespective of whether it's Oberlin, but just from a Division III standpoint, I'm guessing that guys are hanging on for a long, long time to the dream that, hey, I'm still going to get a scholarship from, you know, a Division II or a, you know, a Division I, and they're, even though they might still be talking to you as a Division III coach, there's still a part of them that wants to believe that an offer is going to come in, and so they kind of put those Division III schools on the back burner. Like, do you find that to be the case oftentimes with guys you're recruiting, no matter where they're from?
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword for us. So we don't actually face that problem because our application deadline is a lot earlier than everybody else in this area. So we have to have applications submitted by January 15th.
Gotcha.
So, you know, basically there's a specific kid that is looking for something like this. So, you know, we're fortunate that, you know, kind of the profile of student that you kind of just described probably isn't dealing with us anyway. Those are the kids that are looking for Ivy League, NESCAC, Patriot League, you know, and they also have similar deadlines. So there's a small pocket of those kids that we deal with. But for the most part, you know, I think the application numbers were down this year, but, you know, over the past probably 5 or 6 years, you know, the school's been getting about 7,000 applications for like 700 seats. So they want us to do everything early. So on most years, I'm actually done with recruiting on the early decision one period. So for us, application deadline is November 15. They find out by like December 20th. You know, and then at that point, you know, I'm kicking the tires on some home runs. You know, but at that point I'm pretty much done. So that specific problem I think is more the case with, you know, a lot of our competitors. And I think that goes with the territory too of what's a challenge. You know, some of the better players that are fringe Division I, Division II players end up in our conference and not on our team.
Right. Understood. Completely understand. So those being some of the challenges, what do you love about coaching at Oberlin?
The kids are absolutely amazing. So we have one senior on our team this year that he's possibly the best musician I've ever met in person. You know, sometimes and you were a college athlete, you know how this goes. You preach and you talk about being well-rounded and growing as a student athlete, but you know, really coaches want kids that want to get through school and want to hoop.
Absolutely.
You know, you're a little scared.
Absolutely.
He's talking about taking over the world and, you know, being a leader on campus and being in the music scene and going to open poetry nights and things like that, you're almost kind of like, yeah, we support that. And in your mind thinking, oh, man.
Man, I need this kid to get up more shots.
Exactly. And I was just amazed with my senior this year that he was still probably putting in the most hours of anybody on his own and still doing all these things. And you just realize that, you know, when you're able to, in a lot of cases, it's not even anything I do or say, but you know, if you can just help direct a kid to the right source of motivation, I mean, they can really amaze you. And I think the kids at Oberlin are really special and have a lot of just amazing talents to be around. And I love when they come to my house and my kids get to be around them and see that, you know, break a lot of the stereotypes of athletes.
Yeah, that's very cool. And that's something that I think that, you know, every coach, you know, you hope that one of the things that they value in coaching is the relationships that they're able to build with kids. And I think, you know, I've been fortunate enough to have some exposure to Oberlin from a standpoint of that's where my wife went to school. And then my nephew played on the football team and graduated last year. And now he's in New York City working for a startup that sells some kind of software to restaurants. And then I have another nephew who is a freshman there at Oberlin. So I've had the good fortune of being able to, you know, be on campus and see things. And obviously I got to run the camp last year there. And so I think it's just it's a unique place. And my wife looks at it, looks back at her time there very, very fondly. And, I can honestly say that prior to my relationship with her, I didn't know a whole lot about it. But as I've gotten to know more about it, I can definitely feel the things that you're saying in terms of the uniqueness of the student body and the environment there. And I think that there's a lot for you to be able to sell. And I think that the challenge that I hear coming through is you have to, you know, you have a certain kind of kid that you can recruit, and, you know, you've got to be able to match the basketball with the culture of the greater school. So not only are you trying to think about the culture of your team, but you're also trying to think of the culture of the school as well.
Yeah. And I think there's a nice cross section in certain areas. And that's kind of what, you know, I think has played out on my roster. You know, we've got a lot of, you know, San Francisco, you know, Bay Area kids. You know, I think the culture of Oberlin's campus and walking around and, you know, sort of that vibe, you know, is pretty similar to San Francisco, LA, Boston, New York, you know, just to some degree,
colder,
like Atlanta.
Just a little colder than the Bay Area, right?
What's that? Sorry, I didn't hear
I said
that.
Just a little colder than the Bay Area, right?
Yeah, just a little bit and a lot fewer Warriors fans.
Yeah, which is good.
We'll leave that alone.
No, it's a nice natural fit.
Has it gotten easier from a standpoint of you understanding and knowing what the profile is of the student and the basketball player that you're looking for? Like, do you know sort of where to go, who to talk to, what to look for when you're recruiting a player than it was in your first or second year? Like, do you find that you're able to more easily identify those kids that you have a good chance of getting and bringing to campus?
Yeah, I do. I think when I first got here as an assistant, I think we had 7 healthy bodies and 8 guys on the roster, you know, so sort of your priorities were different back then. You know, I think based on how we've done things over the last probably 8 or 10 years, I always know where to start and I kind of play off the leads from there. But, I think the challenges, I should say the part that's become easier is I don't sweat things that I know don't matter anymore. You know, I think as a young coach, you want to break into this area. There was a big emphasis when I first got here. Hey, we need to do better at recruiting Ohio. And I can't tell you how many trips I made to summer league games and all that stuff. And, you know, at the end of the day, a 26 and a 3.3 at our place was a real stretch. And at every other place they were applying, I mean, they were getting, you know, getting looks at merit money.
Right.
You know, so you stop fighting fights that aren't important and you just kind of follow the leads that make sense. And, you know, I don't have that worry anymore that I'm missing something or I'm leaving something on the table. I know I am, but for every one of those, you know, I'm going to chase down 100 that won't go anywhere. So, and I'm comfortable with that now.
When do you feel like you kind of had a handle on what it takes to be successful there as the head coach? Like, obviously it's an ongoing process and you're never completely comfortable or satisfied with where you are, but at what point do you feel like you got a handle on, you know, the recruiting, the, the aspects of building your team, the, you know, all the things that go into being a successful program. When do you feel like you kind of got what it was going to take in order to have the level of success that you wanted to have?
Whew, that's a tough one, because I don't feel like, and this isn't just coach speak and acting paranoid, I really don't know that I have.
I think, yeah, I understand completely. I mean, I think it's an unfair question, probably.
No, that's good. I definitely get what you're, you know, where you're going with it. I think the sense of comfort, I guess, that I just kind of described, it's more of, there's more of a purpose. I know what roads to go down. You just don't know what's going to be on those roads. You know, and I think the hard part is, you know, you can never really establish new pipelines as you go. I mean, I obviously have a pipeline to both ends of California, you know, but that took 11 years to build. You know, so it's not like I can always go, you know, 30 miles in every direction and have a base of recruiting. So, but I think what I have learned here is that Oberlin student athletes, or at least men's basketball players for our team, we need more individual attention. I was able to sort of manipulate things and change my staff around. So I had two guys around all the time to be there for everybody. You know, anytime someone stopped by, there was someone there to talk to them about anything. You know, I think they want a little bit more immediate feedback and guidance on how to get better. And I don't think you can run this. I don't think you can run the Oberlin program like you would a school that has, you know, 25 guys on the roster. I just don't think that's possible here. And, you know, as long as we're able to give the individual attention to our players, I think we'll continue to be competitive.
So describe for people how you set up your staff and what exactly you mean by that, because there may be some people that don't understand exactly what the challenges are for you in terms of putting your staff together. So can you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I had a great assistant, I guess, slash associate head coach that left me at the end of last year to become the head coach at Lewis and Clark in Oregon. So when I sort of went back to the drawing board, right, and I had a second assistant who's also phenomenal, only with me for a year, who took the head job at Owens Community College. So I got to kind of start over. So I went for two younger guys, two guys that had been very successful in our conference. Jalen Goodwin played at Worcester, graduated in 2015, went to four NCAA tournaments. Nate Axelrod was an All-American and just an absolute nightmare to scout for 8 or 9 games or however many times I faced him. But had seen every defensive coverage geared specifically at him for his entire career, and nobody could stop him. So, but it was a younger group. It was, again, guys who had done it, who had been there, actually played against our players. And I thought that was important to kind of make our guys, I know it's almost comical now because LeBron's been saying it so much, but just made them a little bit uncomfortable and, you know, made them feel like, you know, not only were they in a different position where they could help based on experience, but, you know, there were also guys that they at one point competed against. And I thought that was really neat. So, you know, we have a full-time and a part-time position, but I was able to make them a little closer to being even. Nate was going to go on to play after college, after he graduated last year, and sort of changed his mind on that at a late enough point where a lot of the more traditional positions had been filled, the grad assistant spots and the Division III full-time assistants had already been hired. And so it was almost by chance that he was available. And, you know, so when I had the chance to get these two guys together on the same staff, I did whatever I had to do to get it done.
Yeah, I think that makes a big difference when you have good assistants, when you have guys that you feel fit the culture of what you're trying to do and bring the level of experience that you need. I think that only benefits you, your program, your players, and that's ultimately what you're looking for. Isaiah, we're going to wrap up here by asking you to share out how people can reach out to you if they've listened to the podcast and have questions or just want to, you know, pick your brain about something. So if you wouldn't mind sharing your contact information, and if there's anything else that we didn't hit on tonight that you want to share before we get out of here, you can go ahead and do that as well.
Yeah, no problem. My contact information is, I guess I'll just spell it because I don't have a real traditional name, but it's.
And we'll throw it in the show notes too. So after you spell it, we'll have it in the show notes for people as well.
Cool. It's icavaco@oberlin.edu. So icavaco@oberlin.edu. My office number is 440-775-8407. I'm really good on email, anything that's portable, especially this time of year. Office is not exactly work all the time. So I'm in other gyms and traveling around. So, but no, I really appreciate you guys asking me to do this. And it was a lot of fun. And I actually went through today and listened to some of your previous podcasts, and it was really, really fun just hearing everyone's perspectives. And I definitely invite anybody to reach out. And I'm just kind of I guess the name of your show, I'm just a hoophead, and I'll talk to anybody about anything. And I love expanding kind of my thought process on how to approach this.
Yeah, I love it. Thank you. It's nice of you to say that, we're having a lot of fun with the podcast, and we can't thank you enough for jumping on with us tonight. It's been a pleasure. And, you and I have had some small conversations over the last year or so, but it was nice to really sit down and kind of get to know your backstory. So we appreciate you taking the hour and 15 minutes or so that we've been on. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Head Start Basketball's Player Development Academy offers Cleveland area players a unique opportunity to improve their basketball skills. Regardless of a player's age, skill level, or position, training with Head Start Basketball will elevate your game to the next level. Do you want to improve your ball handling, become a better shooter, or develop into a more skilled, confident player? Our academy classes offer training that's designed to do just that. Our training sessions are innovative and will have you learning skills that are transferable to actual games. We have four different class skill levels for boys and girls, ages 4 and up. All Player Development Academy classes will be held at the Strongsville Recreation Center. For more information or to get registered, please visit www.headstartbasketball.com.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.